Hello and welcome, everyone. This is The LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, May 5th. We're the weekly show on LaRouchePub.com. I'll be hosting today. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and I'm with the economics section of the Executive Intelligence Review News Service. Our topic for today, that is May 5th, 2007, is clearing the tracks for going ahead with mega projects, especially the newly announced commitment to the Bering Straits link between Eurasia and North America, and other projects needed around the world as the rebuilding of the economy responds to, in fact, what we've got right now, which is a financial blowout underway that's breaking down the economy. And I am so glad that we have here with us in the studio and on the telephone lines from both Seattle and Kansas City, Kansas, people who are going to discuss two major events of the last 2 weeks that bears on this idea of clearing the tracks, namely on the issue of removing those forces behind Dick Cheney that are perpetrating war, blocking economic development, and all the rest of it. And so with me here in the studio on this question of Dick Cheney and impeaching Dick Cheney, I welcome from the LaRouche Youth Movement, Mr. Ouyang Teng. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Ouyang has, he hails from California, but he's here in the LaRouche Youth Movement War Room for a stint to help on the cross-firing and coordinating of the strategic impact of just what we're talking about, making way for a major policy shift in the world. And in particular, Ouyang was last week, that is the weekend of April 27 to 30th, in San Diego, California, where the Democratic Party of that state was meeting. He'll be talking about this. I think there were at least something like 3,000 people. But there was a contingent of at least 60 LaRouche Youth Movement leaders there who had a major impact he'll be discussing, and actually succeeded in getting the recourse by name of impeachment into a resolution regarding investigating the wrongdoings of the Bush-Cheney administration. More on that in a few minutes, that firsthand account and the political implications of that. But I also welcome, also with the LaRouche Youth Movement from the central part of the United States, Joe Smalley. Are you with us? Hi.
Hi, Marcia.
Very clear. You're in Kansas City, Kansas, and I know you've people may know you from other shows and in general from your base in the Midwest, Detroit, also Ohio, Indiana, and so forth, with the whole industrial belt that over the last couple years has been all but taken apart because of the inaction of Congress. And we'll hear more from you on the various political economy questions. But lastly, I welcome from Seattle Hal Cooper. Hi.
Hi, Marcia. It's good to talk to you all again.
And Hal is, likewise, many of you know his name, if not his voice, has been a lifelong transportation activist, especially for worldwide rail, land bridge rail corridors on every continent. And he's one of his signatures is the world map taken from different angles of what would be the priority routes on different continents. And he's gone back and forth to Russia, Alaska, and Canada, and the United States for decades over the Bering Strait link that we need a tunnel. And this is part of our topic for today, that there is major action on this. It was April 24th, a few days before that Democratic convention I mentioned, where in Moscow was an international conference on that very thing, the Bering Strait, and having a transport link there. The title of the conference in Moscow was called Mega Projects of Russia's East, a Transcontinental Eurasia-America Transport Link via the Bering Strait. And I'll just, by way of introduction, say the following. Mr. LaRouche, Linda LaRouche, wrote a paper for that. It was requested, and it was delivered there by an associate of his, Dr. Jonathan Tenenbaum in Moscow. Another American of Mr. LaRouche's generation, Walter Hickel from Alaska, who I remember well over the decades, who was once governor there. He then served in the cabinet here in Washington, D.C. for a while. I think that was under the Nixon administration. And Walter Hickel prepared a paper about finally going and making this link up between Alaska and Eastern Russia. Other people spoke, but behind that conference is a whole institutional drive in Russia, and the prospect of mobilizing forces here in the United States, in Canada, and elsewhere around the world has shot way ahead under the optimism that that this can be done. We're at a critical period for making a shift towards this kind of thing. And that's the topic we have today. Now, let's start this way. We want to hear about the potential for a political shift in this direction, away from the perpetual war that characterizes the Cheney-Bush regime and the people financially that put them in to begin with. And so in a few minutes, we'll hear from Hal Cooper about some of the specifics of how you build a tunnel, what the history's been, this and that. But first, Ouyang, from the Democratic Party of California, anything else you want to say about Louisiana or any, please put us in the picture on what you see is happening.
Well, LaRusha described the process in the webcast that he gave last Tuesday, where he had a number of colorful metaphors to describe it. But the idea that he was getting across was that impeachment is something that is more popular than ice cream in the country. And that there's a huge reservoir in the population of, you know, sentiment against Cheney that would support Cheney's impeachment, including from political layers. But so that's not the problem holding impeachment back. It isn't a question of popular sentiment, but that there's another element to this that, you know, he said had to be uncorked, and effectively that there's a bomb out there that we were simply the fuse for. This past weekend, in particular, at the California Democratic State Convention. So, you know, we went in there with the idea of effectively bringing two issues to the table. They were already on the table, at least the question of impeachment. But to really make the California Democratic Convention a launching point for a national mobilization around Kucinich's impeachment bill, which had just been introduced the week before, and also to you know, bury the Al Gore global warming CO2 hoax that he's been pushing, and make sure that we cleave the Democratic Party from that outlook and the implications of taking up a policy of, you know, shutting down industry and taking the issue away from the immediate crisis of the economic collapse and Cheney. So what was interesting is we found there was already a lot of motion. There was a lot of bustle around, you know, there's a lot of opposition around the impeachment question. But and we had about, you know, we had about 60 people there. And the intervention was probably the most focused that we've had over the last 4 years that we've been going to these things. And it's been, each time has represented a process of development with, you know, our relationship to the Democratic Party, and in particular in advancing the policy discussion in the party nationally. And so this year was unique, number one, because we had two people that were actually elected, two members of the youth movement who were elected to statewide positions, Quincy and Wyneal, who were on the show last week. And that was significant because it's come out of a process of discussion and dialogue within the party and organizing, and the fact that they recognize that we're, you know, the most active force in the country, particularly, you know, and definitely in the state, in terms of organizing a real, you know, cutting edge in politics. So that has changed the discussion process already within the party. The other thing that was necessary was to get some kind of break on the impeachment question per se. So there was some resolutions that we had. There was a resolution that we had submitted to the state party that had already been passed by the LA County Central Committee, Democratic Central Committee, which is the biggest in the country, on Cheney's impeachment. There were also a number of other resolutions, three other resolutions that were submitted by various other people in the party on impeachment as well. So during the resolutions committee on Friday, we got to speak to it in addition to some of these other people. But there was already a top-down operation to suppress this. And so their stance on the Resolutions Committee was basically a pretty weak claim that they'd already spoken to the issue, that it was, you know, not really relevant because they had passed a resolution last year where they had said, well, we'll investigate possible abuses by Bush, you know, and take actions that are necessary for that. So it was a real kind of sidestepping, you know, thing that was done, but it was clearly dictated from the top. And we've identified some of the problems and the financial elements in the party that are actually controlling the debate. Felix Rowatin, for example. So we mobilized. We were part of a discussion process that night. And in particular, you know, heading in through the next day, this is now with the election of Quincy and Wyneal, and the intervention with our chorus, which we had about a 30-member strong chorus. We had about 60 people all together. But what you had was an environment that was built up. By the time that the second Resolutions Committee hearing was held on Saturday, I mean, there was a real shift in the dynamic at the convention. Part of that was actually fed by a resolution, an impeachment resolution that had been passed in Louisiana just that day. That was actually introduced by a LaRouche associate in Louisiana that had been passed by the state Democratic Party executive board there, which we fed directly into the convention that no one else had heard about, and used that to, you know, mobilize the forces there. And so the end result was that there was an impeachment resolution, or a resolution with an impeachment clause that was passed by the Democratic Party. But I think it's just a reflection of the fact that we've really broken open the policy discussion and the terms of discussion in the party. And that's obviously just the most urgent issue. But most of the organizing wasn't limited to that. It was largely driven, and this is a point that LaRouche has made, that if you're going to get impeachment, you've got to actually do it from the standpoint that there's something better that you've got to organize for, that people are going to recognize has to be, that they're going to see the impeachment question as necessary as a precondition. And so what we had going in there were these display boards and, you know, and the literature and the developments around the land bridge, you know, showing maglev rail, showing the Eurasian land bridge routes, showing nuclear power and the possibilities for, you know, resource creation and nuclear desalination and these types of things. And so it was a real kind of optimistic lunge on the question of economic development. And that effectively, if people are responding to that and they see the political discussion as bounded by a sense of what we've got to do for the future around these kinds of, you know, this great projects perspective that Lynn has laid out around China, Russia, U.S., and India, then it immediately changes their sense of what they think is practical or what they should do with respect to the impeachment question. It's almost, you know, a non-issue. It's just a no-brainer.
Right. Well, that's a perfect lead-in, Hal, to... Why don't you give us an opening short briefing on this great project of the Bering Strait Tunnel to make the rail link? Let me just throw in right here that the April 24th conference I mentioned in Moscow issued an appeal to governments around the world, but especially to the Group of Eight that's going to meet in Germany in June. It might be the second week in June in Heiligendamm. And this appeal is for this specific project of the Bering Strait, but it identifies the kind of thing that Ouyang just mentioned, the impact that such a project would have for the general betterment of everyone, a great project. And I'm just going to put a pitch in. People should look at the constantly updated website to get the text of this appeal, to get a report on the Democratic Convention that Ouyang just gave, and that is on LaRouche Political Action Committee. It's LaRouchePAC.com, PAC.com. So, Hal, this Bering Strait, what, to begin with, speaking of hopefulness, here's the chance. You've been describing this for decades. How long is it? How would it be built? What were they discussing in Moscow?
Marcia, thank you very much for asking me to speak at this conference call. I have been very closely following the Bering Strait tunnel situation, and in fact, I just recently completed a feasibility study for a company in Canada on actually building a railroad up to Alaska from British Columbia, and of course, the the whole project is very much contingent on building the Bering Strait Tunnel because of the impacts it would have on the traffic growth and economic development and so forth. What is being proposed is a 65-mile-long tunnel between Ulan in Chukotka in the far northeast of Russia and Wales in the far west of Alaska to connect the two underneath the Bering Strait as a railroad tunnel. This would require the construction of approximately 4,500 to 5,000 miles of railroad to connect the existing networks. In this case, Prince George, British Columbia, with Yakutsk in the Sakhalin Republic in Russia, so that there would be a connection to the main railroad system in Russia, as well as to the main railroad in North America. It would be a double-track railroad, and it would go over the entire distance, and it would be electrified, and it would be able to haul large quantities of all types of different cargoes and passengers. It would ultimately have a connection to the west of Russia along the Arctic Ocean, and there would be other connections into the United States down into North Dakota, and in fact all the way down through the central part of the United States to as far south as Mexico, which ultimately would connect to a rail system connecting Central and South America into this entire network. And it would have a whole series of power plants, industrial plants, mining operations, and all types of things like that that would be built along the railroad in what is presently relatively unpopulated area in northern British Columbia, the Yukon Territory, Alaska, Chukotka, the Magadan and Koryak regions of northeastern Russia and the Sakhalin Republic, where it would connect into the main rail networks. And this would be a major economic development activity that would ultimately involve China, India, the United States, Russia, Canada, and Mexico, and, of course, virtually every other country that would be involved to some extent. And it would be able to facilitate the shipment of large quantities of containers, oil, coal, all types of different commodities, and also passengers. So you would have a very new system opening up. And this would make it possible, believe it or not, to ship containers to and from Asia and North America, particularly China and the United States, in a way that actually is shorter in time and possibly cheaper than the existing ways to ship, with a considerable savings in time and cost of moving cargoes. So that, in a nutshell, is what is being proposed. And, of course, this conference that took place over in Moscow was really designed to promote the development of that idea based around the idea in the strategic interest of Russia, of course, of selling oil and gas and electricity to the United States, but really facilitating international trade and economic growth and development.
Great. And to zero in on something that came up before the show began, people often ask, the tunnel itself is a question of boring in the rock stratum. Could you describe that? Is it to be likened to the channel between England and France, or can you just
say
something about it?
That's a very similar type of a project. And, of course, in there you have a 31-mile tunnel. It's a double-track tunnel, two separate tubes, and then there's a central utility tube in the middle. And it has places at both ends where trucks drive up, and they get on, they actually move the whole truck onto a train, and they haul it under the English Channel, and then they're unloaded at the other side. The passenger trains go straight through from either Paris or Brussels or wherever they come from to London, and I understand that they're now of close to having the high-speed rail connection from Kent, very close to Dover, all the way into London, so that this will cut another 45 minutes or so off the travel time and make it possible for the people to go from England to France or Belgium or wherever they're going at less time and a lower cost than it would by airplanes.
Right. Now, there may be some questions here from Ouyang or from Joe and others, but shall we throw in some history about this? You've followed it in the last 20 years very much, Hal, but this goes back as a concept 100 years, right? And certainly after the Second World War, it had an impetus because of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So what is a need-to-know recap of this?
Well, it goes back to the time of Abraham Lincoln, and William Gilpin was the territorial governor of Colorado who first proposed that there be a railroad built between North America and Asia and Europe. And this was actually promoted later on by none other than Edward H. Harriman from the Union Pacific Railroad at the turn of the century, where he actually proposed doing that. And his way of dealing with the Bering Strait was to put a dam there and have the trains go over basically on top of the dam. That never went very far. However, in 1906, there was a company created in the state of New Jersey, and there was a French count who was the president of the company, and they raised $6 million to start moving on getting this project built. And the company was actually had participants from France, Russia, and the United States. And they actually had commitments raised for $350 million to begin the design and construction of the of this railroad. Interestingly enough, going basically over approximately the same route that I just presented to you, going through from the northwest of the United States through northwestern Canada and Alaska, through the northeast of Russia, down to connect to what was then the Trans-Siberian Railroad at a place called Skovorodino in the Amur region of northeastern Russia.
Right.
And that was an early effort. Some people, including in the LaRouche organization, and I happen to be a believer that this is actually true, it is my belief that the British financial and maritime interests decided to create the conditions by which World War I would happen to prevent this project from happening, because at all costs they were trying to stop Eurasian land development and land-based economic development, which would compromise at that time their maritime interests, but ultimately their financial control. And it would open up many new mineral resources in Canada and northeastern Russia, which certainly would have threatened those investments in Africa. And that was, I think, another part of this. Although I can't prove that, it is my opinion that that is the case. Now, up at the time of World War II, The situation was that in the 1930s, in the late 1930s, Stalin commissioned a series of studies to be done of building railroad lines across the eastern part of Russia for the purpose of economic development. And one of those was to come from Forkuta, way over in the west of the country, about 1,100 miles northeast of Moscow, all the way to Ulenin Bering Strait, basically on the south shore of the Arctic Ocean. And some small sections of this were built, all of it was surveyed, some of it was graded, and all the initial design was done. But it would have required four major bridges over the major rivers of northern Russia to be built. Then, separately, there was another line coming down to the southwest from Ulen, which would go to Yakutsk and to Skovorodino and connect into the Trans-Siberian Railway. And, of course, that the southern sections of that were built as part of their economic development programs of the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, and continued into the 1970s, but they were ended up being spur lines to access specific mineral resources. That was what they were doing. In 1941, when Pearl Harbor was attacked by the Japanese, Russia, or the Soviet Union at that time, immediately notified the Roosevelt administration to please have Harry Hopkins come over to Moscow for a series of meetings with their foreign minister Molotov and Stalin and all of the other people who were involved. And those took place during mid to late December of 1941. And, of course, the purpose of this meeting was how could the United States supply Russia in their war effort? Because the Russians had been pushed way back from June to November of 1941 across all the front of Russia and the western part of the Soviet Union. And the Germans were on the gates of Moscow, and of course what saved them was the winter and all those Yakutian soldiers from the Tsar Republic. It wasn't called the Tsar Republic then, but that's the region where these people came from. But in the discussions that took place, they had a number of options for supplying Russia from the Soviet Union, from the United States, ships to Iran, ships to Murmansk and Archangel, air service by way of from the United States through Canada to Russia, of eastern Russia, and which ultimately ended up happening. And then they did discuss the railway possibility of a Bering Strait tunnel, but it was a a major project. They were already heavily involved in the war, fighting, and so it wasn't a high priority, but it was certainly brought up. Franklin Roosevelt's uncle, Frederick Delano, went to him and said, "Franklin, you need to look at this railroad." So there was a study commissioned by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers from the Seattle District to go up into Canada and actually do a survey and cost estimate and feasibility study of building the railroad line. And actually it would go through the Rocky Mountain Trench and along what is now the Alaska Highway right-of-way to be built. But what ended up happening was this study took about 6 months, and at the same time they were looking at the road, and they needed to build a road because they had to supply these airplanes going over to Russia. So they built a series of, I think it was 8 airports between Great Falls, Montana, and Fairbanks and Nome, Alaska, so that the planes could fly and carry supplies. And what would happen is they would stock the supplies in Great Falls, Montana. They would fly them to either Nome or Fairbanks, and the Russians would come across. And they had already been trained on how to use these planes. And then they flew back the planes and the supplies to the Soviet Union, and they kept the planes and they kept the supplies. And, of course, that did help their war effort to a considerable extent. But it was sort of the back door. And there was a study actually commissioned, feasibility study, actually went from near Prince George, British Columbia, up through Fairbanks and all the way out to Teller, just to the southeast of Wales at the Bering Strait. And the Russians, interestingly enough, starting in 1937, had been doing their own feasibility studies up until 1940 of these rail lines across northeastern Russia. And actually, they were primarily to connect their concentration camps, which is, you know, not a nice way to needing to be build railroads. But this, is, of course, was the political tenor of the time in the Soviet Union under the rule of Stalin. But this all came about and was actually being actively discussed in 1941. Well, what ended up happening, the real reason the Alaska Railroad was never built, was there was a concern in building the railroad to defend Alaska in case of a Japanese attack, because the rail would be the best transport for all the military equipment and supplies and so forth. Well, the Battle of Midway happened in June of 1942, and while the Japanese did send a small expeditionary force into the Aleutian Islands, their main attack was concentrated at Midway, and as you know, they basically lost the war then. After Midway, they were on the defense after that when they lost their 4 main aircraft carriers, and the United States was very victorious, and ultimately that led to Japan's defeat. And there was no real serious concern about a major invasion of Alaska after June of 1942, which is when the political impetus to build the railroad went down. The other problem the railroad had was there was a severe shortage of steel at the time because of the war, and that project didn't have a high enough priority as compared to building tanks and trucks and all the other things that you need for the military for steel, so it didn't get built. But there was certainly a serious interest in that. At the end of the war, Stalin approached Harry Truman about the Bering Strait Tunnel, and he was very rudely rebuffed. And, of course, Truman, as the Lewis Organization has clearly pointed out on a number of occasions, Franklin Roosevelt was very much against the British agenda. Harry Truman went along with it. And as a result, it was a very different response. And also, Roosevelt, at the time World War II began, when these discussions were held with Harry Hopkins, Winston Churchill bitterly opposed supporting Russia. He thought Russia and Nazi Germany, Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, should be allowed to fight each other to death with no help from the outside, and he was basically overruled by Roosevelt. Roosevelt said the Soviet Union is our ally, we're going to help them, and he overruled Winston Churchill.
Well, that brings us up to actually what Ouyang was beginning with in the Democratic Party, because part of the LaRouche Youth Movement in California is the FDR Legacy Club of the Democratic Party of the Los Angeles area. And just as you say, under Franklin Delano Roosevelt was the period when the Alaska, Yukon, or British Columbia, Canada, U.S. Railway was at least surveyed in 1942. It was in 1944 that President Roosevelt sent his vice president, Henry Wallace, to East Russia, who flew all over the place.
Right.
And he said, as soon as the war is over, one of the most important frontiers of the world will be what he called the North Pacific. He called it, we're going to have a Pacific era. and Alaska and Chukotka will be the development frontiers of the world, which didn't happen under Truman and later.
Right.
So let's turn to the implications that were raised, Ouyang raised, is that turning people's eyes to the horizon of development again, if we can get Cheney move ahead and get rid of the obstacles, get rid of what you just called the British agenda. Joe, you're out there in Kansas, Missouri era, but you've been working with the industrial communities of our country. What do you say about two things? The kind of corridors of development that we could anticipate from these rail lines that Hal sketched in, and secondly, the uptake, the willingness of people to grasp this, to want to retool. What do you think?
Well, I'd actually start with the first one. What is the sort of consensus of people about these type of projects? One thing that's an observation here in Kansas City and throughout I see in other major what were once great industrial and agricultural centers where people were very productive. The economies were based upon production and the distribution of goods. Now what we're seeing is that these old industrial areas, whether it be in Cleveland or in Detroit or here in Kansas City, which are usually adjacent to railroad yards, some will call them the warehouse districts, are now being used as major money makers for real estate developers, where they're converting what were once warehouses into lofts, into trendy restaurants and shops, try to bring back the sort of feel for the city that's been lost because there's a loss of production over the past 30 years especially. That's an interesting observation because most people tend to think that that type of urban development or redevelopment of the center areas of cities is very positive. You know, it's bringing back this type of charm that people can walk around on the streets. They don't have to drive everywhere in the suburbs. But in reality, it's not even close to a solution because the biggest aspect of an urban civilization is the productivity part, which when you separate it, what you have essentially is a real estate bubble. And this is significant. I would like, I'm looking now to the corridor development that Hal has developed in concept and these studies that are being done. I have a question because there's a common myth about the interstate highway system that this was something that can be compared to our rail system that was developed before the interstate highway system, but with the development of automobiles and the construction of a national highway system, you see the expansion of cities, but not the actual development of new cities. So a question for Hal is how you sort of see the difference between a national highway system, which certainly brought benefits to primary use for defense, but also being able to facilitate travel for people and for commercial goods as well, but that it didn't actually lead to the development of new cities. Why?
Well, I think that's not its biggest problem. Its biggest problem is the whole concept of the idea of the interstate highway system was really built upon the extension of the Autobahn program in Germany. And this whole concept of transportation was based on the issue of cheap oil. If we had cheap oil, we could do it. If we didn't have it, we couldn't do it. And what this ended up doing was, we created all the sprawl. We decimated the downtown areas of many of our cities, which are sort of recasting themselves because of this. But as you say, we've lost the productive capability that goes with that. Now, the interstate highway system, yes, it had some benefits for rural areas and so forth, but it also had some detrimental features. But what I think what it ultimately did was it put this country at very serious risk from an energy standpoint, and it also inhibited our desire and necessity to use more electricity and then nuclear power.
And one thing, can I just throw in, about the corridors you laid out, Hal, and one of which we could imagine coming right down through North America, because you can hardly go north-south easily, and you should be able to go through Central America, Colombia, and South America.
Right.
But you're talking about electrified rail everywhere, just to underscore it for people.
Right.
Well, that was part of the reason I was asking that question, because if you look at the part of the country stretching from North Dakota through South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, and the adjacent states, you have what is certainly a depopulation characteristic.
Absolutely.
And this is and also a very low population density. So if you were looking at this, from a development perspective, would simply the construction of a, I guess the point is that the construction of a railroad takes on a much greater significance, because then you're not simply looking to transport people or goods from point A to point B.
Right.
But
as you may be aware, and Marcia certainly is aware, in my feasibility study, one of the issues that I was asked to look at was what's the possibility for development of this Central North American trade corridor from North Dakota to Texas that you referred to, which would then be extended into Latin America. So I did. I went from Bismarck down to Del Rio, drove all through that whole area. And as you say, it's basically depopulated. It's rural America. It's not very prosperous. The largest city in the whole region is in the whole route is Abilene, Texas, at 116,000 people, and nothing else is over 100,000. And there's probably all of about 500,000 people live all along that corridor, and there's really not very much. Well, in further work I've been doing, particularly in North Dakota and to some extent in Texas and in South Dakota, is looking at that as an energy corridor. That's where we should be building power plants and industrial plants and things that maybe they don't want in other areas, and build it all along there, and build a water facility, which the Roosh program has also been very much active in promoting as a part of that whole concept.
Now, one thing, too, what about the particulars? Looking at the horizon again, in East Russia and the Yukon, Alaska, and so forth, I understand Walter Hickel said on April 24th, you have all of the elements of the periodic table in East Russia.
In the Sahara Republic, you most certainly do. They say that was Mendeleev's region.
Okay. And so the potential for development, if we're going back to FDR and taking the legacy and picking up where, going back to where we left off 60 years ago, that we could restore population density to the areas of the Midwest that lost it over the last 20 years,
correct,
and then have untold density that we never had in the Yukon or elsewhere, is what you're saying.
That is correct.
One thing, let me ask a political question here of Ouyang, that you had a town hall meeting, too, I understand, in San Diego during the period of the proceedings of the convention, and also our elected colleagues of the LaRouche Youth Movement, Quincy O'Neill, Wyneal Innocentes. There's discussion about future town hall meetings, but how do you see engaging people in the war room, either here or abroad, in these, what can be in the prospects, just as we've been discussing them?
Yeah, well, that was somewhat the idea behind the chartering of the FDR Legacy Club, which is that we've got to build up the Democratic Party as a grassroots, mass-based organization again, where you're actually going to engage the key sections of the population in a a certain depth of discussion around, in particular, things like rail, nuclear power, you know, economic development, federal credit. And so, you know, it's been that. There's been an interesting also collaboration with certain people in the scientific community. You know, youth, obviously, and then the elected political leadership. And it's something that, from the standpoint of, you know, taking over the Democratic Party, we really have no competition. That it, when it comes to these questions of policy, you know, it's just there's not much that can be argued over. You know, I mean, the argument should happen. That would be actually progress. But there's not much that can be said, you know, to refute the necessity for these development corridors, right, and the idea of a rail system, which when we organize, most people, you know, they can get excited by that idea.
Right.
So it's the obstacles are they're never objections really based on the merits of the policy. It's always this other question, this thing that LaRouche has brought up, that people have this kind of monster in their mind that says, no, there are certain things you just can't do.
Yeah, that's because that's been created for them by these economic and financial interests who control our economy and media and who all want us to indulge in a culture of intellectual monothink.
Yeah, right.
And there's something else that I think is very much, and you know, this is something that shouldn't be limited to the Democratic Party. And I go back to something that happened in the state of Montana in the election campaign in 2004. Brian Schweitzer, the Democrat, was elected because the Republican Party was taken over by the far right-wing, religious, fundamentalist, conservative people who didn't want to do anything, they didn't want to spend any money, they didn't want to develop anything. They just wanted to leave everything just the way it was so they didn't have to pay more taxes. And they pushed the moderate and the small business people out of the Republican Party, and they became Democrats. And that's why Brian Schweitzer got elected. And I think the small business community is up for grabs in this country to support what we're talking about, because they, more than anybody, are benefited by economic growth and development. And they are hurt worse than anybody by economic stagnation. And, of course, they're also hurt by this increasing control of this fascist corporate state type group where we have a few large companies that are favored and forget everybody else.
Let me throw in here, Hal and Joe and Ouyang, that there, and everyone, you should know, there's a new strategic policy document Lyndon LaRouche finished just in the last couple days, and it's going to be posted on LaRouchePack.com and LaRouchePub.com. Here's the title: End Game Forecasts. Just about the kind of thing you're talking about. The de facto, you've got certain financial interests, hedge funds, to be polite, but syndicates buying out everything from Heinz ketchup to I don't know what. And we're in a crash phase, as shown in the mortgage-backed securities and so forth and other respects of the currencies around the world. And so what's going to come out of this phase, either the kind of development directionality we're just talking about, the economic projects, re-putting people back to work and businesses and so forth, or we're going to have the dark age. So make sure and read that, the end game forecasts, and look for that within the next 24 hours of May 5th. And the other thing Ouyang mentioned, May 1st, Lyndon LaRouche gave an international webcast. It was based out of Washington, D.C., and that is the transcription of that, as well as the video archive, is available on LaRouchePack.com. So I wanted to make sure people knew that directly. And to resume on this question of people's, Ouyang, you said that there's already a hatred for Cheney. And so Hal's saying there's already a disgust on the economic side with the fact of the breakdown. And now, we could discuss more about the projects, the Bering Strait and so forth. That's our topic for today. But you also, Ouyang, mentioned we have to go up against the submission to this crazy Al Gore Schwarzenegger roadshow on this scientific hoax of global warming. That how thick or how thin do you find that is when you try and organize people, and especially in California?
Well,
as an obstacle to, you were mentioning obstacles.
Yeah, I mean the all of those, you know, people have it, depending on where you are in the country, you know, the flavor might be different in the Bay Area as it might be where Joe is out in Kansas, or in terms of
this. That could be called an understatement.
Yeah, but underlying, you know, whether or not you've got someone who's, you know, a total over the top greenie saying we should go back to the trees and wear loincloths and, you know, have communal living, or, you know, somebody, some hardcore right winger, anti-government, you know, or maybe religious fundamentalists, you have underlying it the same essential epistemological outlook, the same philosophical outlook, which is this question that, you know, they don't have the conception of themselves, and therefore they don't have the conception of mankind as being any kind of creative, you know, agent in the universe to intervene.
That's very true.
So, like on the economics, I know I never really thought about, I never had a passionate love for rail or maglev before I joined the movement, but the way that LaRouche has developed the idea of, you know, even a development corridor or the land bridge is really a beautiful conception of what mankind is, that you can actually, you know, treat the planet like a garden, and we've got to actually manage the biosphere.
Right.
I'd be interested to know, to ask how you got into this. I don't know if I'd call it the business, or how you got into the mission to around rail and this question of development.
Well, I was always interested. Marcia grew up in Altoona, in Pennsylvania, and I grew up in Bound Brook, New Jersey, and both of those are railroad towns. My father didn't work for a railroad, but I was always interested in trains. When we moved to California, I kind of got away from it, and then when I started teaching, I got back by just getting involved in doing some studies on electrifying railroads from the energy standpoint, and from that it sort of recurred. And then I read about the early work by George Kumal about the Bering Strait Tunnel, and became interested in that because I'm a member of the American Railway Engineering Association, and I went to his meeting and gave this first paper that Marcia has, and Marcia knows that when I finished, Mr. Kumal, after I presented the case as to why we should build it in terms of commodities, looked at me and he said, "Hal, if I knew you were going to talk about this, I would never have invited you." And I said, "George, if you don't discuss the issues that I presented in this paper, how are you going to get this project done?" And I said, "The answer is, you're not going to." Well, that kind of led us into a stalemate, and you notice I didn't get invited to that conference over in Moscow, and I suspect George Kumal had something to do with that, but I did get invited interviewed by, in addition to Marcia, by the Associated Press last week on the Bering Strait Tunnel as aftermath of the conference. And so I've been very much interested, but it started because of my interest in air pollution and control and energy was why I became interested in this. And it's sort of gone on from there, and now suddenly the movement is starting to attract numerous other people. And I was very pleased. One of the reasons I joined the LaRouche organization was the fact that they were promoting similar ideas, and I certainly didn't see the Democratic or Republican parties doing it, and I felt these people are increasingly out to lunch, and that's exactly what they are. And I think that's one of the biggest advantages that we have, is that the party structures, Republicans in particular, are need to come in and have lunch. You know, I mean, they're just not with it. And the Democrats are coming around a little bit, and I think this intervention that the LaRouche movement did in San Diego with the Democratic convention, I noticed this caused Donald to consider maybe he needed to support the high-speed rail project, because, you know, those of us that pointed out to him that, gee, it does need oil, maybe he needs to listen to that. And if he's going to say, well, we need to do something about global warming, maybe he needs to do something besides drive SUVs and trucks and all that. And so that's, you know, a very important thing. Marcia, I have a little bit of a logistical problem.
Yes.
It's getting close to 1 o'clock, and I'm going to need to go to the bank to get my money before.
Okay, so we're on the air, and we'll have to say farewell. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I think so. And I very much enjoyed this get together and discussion. And I'm sure this is the first of many more discussions.
That's right. And thank you. And thank you. And people, Hal, you can, in thanking you, and we'll say goodbye, people can also look for your latest interview summarizing the kinds of things you said that will be posted on LaRouchePub.com within 48 hours.
That'll be wonderful. And when does it come out in the magazine?
This coming week it will be dated May 11th. And thank
Please
you so much.
Send copies to me. I will look forward to receiving them.
Okay, bye-bye.
And thanks for everybody. Bye-bye.
See you.
We still have 10 minutes. This is the LaRouche Show, May 5th, 2007. And as you know, we're weekly from 3 to 4 Eastern Time in the United States on www.larouchepub.com. And we want to continue on this discussion. I think we were on the political track, so to speak, of the World Land Bridge Railroad. And one thing is I'll just throw in here that what was on this question of people being falling for or getting subverted into the pessimism of crazy climate change fears and so forth, or going along with that, you know that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that's releasing a report this year was set up as an operation in 1988, especially by the British ambassador at the time to the United Nations. But it issued number 3 of 4 reports coming out this year, just yesterday in Bangkok, Thailand. The principal author was Jonathan Pollard, who is the advisor to Arnold Schwarzenegger on, guess what, how to have governments cap carbon dioxide emissions so you can trade in them. It couldn't be more sleazy. And Jonathan Pershing, did I say Jonathan Pollard? I'm thinking of the spy. Jonathan Pershing is also on the World Resources Institute, on whose board is Al Gore. So you get the Schwarzenegger-Gore direct connection to Jonathan Pershing, whose specifics in this report include how you should have trade in futures and so forth on the Chicago Climate Exchange. So it's just like monetizing genocide. You deny people the right to industry and agriculture, and then you trade in it for a time period. So we can put more out on that. That's not our topic today. That's what the kind of thing that people might fall for. But there was one question where we don't have Hal Cooper's expertise on what goes into every mile of building rail or building a tunnel. But the question of tooling up to do this. We've lost a lot of capacity in the United States in the last couple of years because of the takedown of the auto sector. But Joe, you're there in actually Kansas City, Missouri has a Ford plant and other auto capacity, as does St. Louis, as does a lot of states. What do you think about the impact of the motion and optimism of having the Bering Strait and other mega projects back on the agenda for India, China, Russia, and the United States for tooling up again, even if we lost a lot? What's your impression?
Well, undoubtedly, it would be a great thing. It would send shockwaves throughout the Midwest. And also, I mean, just considering the amount of skilled workers that are in this region who have been recently laid off because of the collapse in auto industry and the related supply chains to that industry. So those people who have the working capability, you know, they're still there, even though they're leaving at record rates, leaving the state of Michigan. But one really important aspect of this, on the other side of it, is right now looking at younger people who are currently might be university age or slightly younger. You know, they're coming out of school. If they are able to get a job, as almost any college student would admit that he's going to school right now, probably not to learn things or at least to really develop his mind, but mostly because he sees it as a way to get a job. And, you know, that's not a terrible thing. It's not the worst sin in the world to want to get a job and be able to earn money. The problem being that if you go to any business school, you're going to be employed, probably not self-employed, probably as somewhere up in a hierarchy of a very, very large corporation, which is very much involved in what Howe is describing as a sort of a corporate fascism, profiting through looting of other countries, through ensuring through globalization, as we've described it extensively in the EIR. And what this type of development projects and corridor developments really opens up is a question, is the bringing together of the entrepreneurship that with the contributions to society as a whole. And this is an idea of the American system that our founding fathers had, Alexander Hamilton especially, going on to the Careys, Matthew Carey and Henry C. Carey, carried over into this incredible boom in the late 19th century, where we saw the greatest industrial expansion on the face of the planet up to that point. And you saw urbanization, you saw new inventions, raising standard of living, and population increase, more people. That's the type of optimism where people were able to have their own businesses, were able to go to school. This is also the time where you had the agricultural and technical mechanical institutes based upon Abraham Lincoln's land-grant university system, where they spread a university to every single state in the country. And people were employed and being educated in order to gain employment in something that would be productive to the entire union and essentially to the entire world as well, knowing with the history of the United States and Russia-Germany collaboration at that time period. Well, that is what we are, that is the potential today. That potential exists right now, and it's something that whether people are already skilled workers or are still in universities today, that we are right now organizing for. And I mean that is very optimistic in that sense, that people don't have to see a dichotomy, the dichotomy between education and, you know, earning a living is not in conflict with benefiting the country. Unfortunately, it may appear so today, but it doesn't have to be that way.
Let me throw in a plug here. Just what you said about this late 1900s in the United States industrial boom, the great 1876, was at the Philadelphia National Exhibit and so forth. But there, this project by the LaRouche Youth Movement, among many projects that were done in the last 18 months, one was called Travel Among Cities, where and I want people to go on the LaRouche Youth Movement. You can go on LaRouche Political Action Committee website, LaRouchePAC.com. Look for going on to the LaRouche Youth Movement site and look for something called Travel Among Cities, because it shows before your eyes in motion the county by county increase in population density over this period of the new United States, the decade by decade over the 1800s, then into the 1900s, and the rail network across the country. So some of the highest density of rail in the rural counties of the High Plains and elsewhere was in the 1920s, and towns all over the place. So have a look at that, and also it's going to make you want to contribute resources, financial resources. Sign up yourself, your friends, your enemies, your government officials to Executive Intelligence Review Online. Contribute, because I think that's the peer, we are at that stage. So Joe, thanks for bringing that up, because any age, we just look at that, Travel Among Cities. And Ouyang, let me ask you then, since Mr. Kucinich in the House of Representatives issued his bill of impeachment a couple of weeks ago, listing why Dick Cheney should be impeached, a couple more people have signed on. I mean, there's more interest in this, but how should we look at the upcoming weeks? You're in the LaRouche Youth Movement war room in the way of what we're trying to, how we're trying to engage people.
Well, I mean, I think we're at a point where there could be a really rapid breakthrough on the impeachment question. Like we saw just in the last week, two extra congressmen having signed on, two states having submitted impeachment resolutions.
Which ones are those?
Well, Louisiana, at least the Democratic Party.
That's right.
Two states.
That's a big...
But, I mean, you know, I can report just in the last few days there have been a number of effective interventions on this question. There was a town hall meeting in Houston, or near Houston, with a congressman there, where we sort of unleashed again at this snowball effect amongst the people that were at this town hall meeting on the question of impeaching Cheney. And it's going to be something that's brought up this weekend at the Massachusetts State's Young Democrats Convention by our Boston Youth Movement local out there, which they'll certainly raise in 2 weeks also out at the State Democratic Convention. And so, you know, it's a question that we're posing to people, and we're finding a lot of traction in terms of getting other people to demand, you know, the same type of action. So I think it'll, to the extent that we get a certain you know, threshold that's passed, you're going to find this thing takes on a life of its own, because it is, you know, probably one of the most popular projects in the country right now that unfortunately a lot of these front runners haven't quite yet caught on to.
That's right.
The fad.
Well, as you said earlier, or somebody did, it's more it's a favorite, even more than ice cream, for anyone to get Dick Cheney out of the way. He was the official greeter this week in Virginia to the Queen of England, speaking of the British agenda. And Dick Cheney's intending to go to the Mideast, Southwest Asia, for 6 days, beginning on Tuesday, the 8th. So we want to move fast, engage everyone in it. Our time has run out. So I want to thank Joe Smalley, Ouyang Teng. Thanks to Hal Cooper. And this is May 5th signing off for The LaRue Show. On May 12th, 2007, please tune in again for Harley Schlanger and guests as we continue. Thank you all very much, and good afternoon.